Welcome to Reading the Classics on KRBD. I'm Kelly Johnson with the Ketchikan Public Library, and I'll be continuing Frankenstein by Mary Shelley. Yet one duty remained to me, the recollection of which finally triumphed over my selfish despair. It was necessary that I should return without delay to Geneva, there to watch over the lives of those I so fondly loved, and to lie in wait for the murderer that if any chance led me to the place of his concealment, or if he dared again blast me by his presence, I might with unfailing aim put an end to the existence of the monstrous image which I had endured with the mockery of a soul still more monstrous. My father still desired to delay our departure, fearful that I could not sustain the fatigues of a journey, for I was shattered wreck, the shadow of a human being. My strength was gone. I was a mere skeleton, and fever night and day preyed upon my wasted frame. Still, as I urged our leaving Ireland with such inquietude and impatience, my father thought best to yield. We took our passage on board a vessel bound for Havre de Grace, and sailed with a fair wind from the Irish shores. It was midnight. I lay on the deck looking at the stars and listening to the dashing of the waves. I hailed the darkness that shut Ireland from my sight, and my pulse beat with feverish joy when I reflected that I should soon see Geneva. The past appeared to me in the light of a frightful dream, yet the vessel in which I was, the wind which blew me from the detested shore of Ireland, and the sea which surrounded me, told me too forcibly that I was deceived by no vision, and that Clavero, my friend and dearest companion, had fallen victim to me and the monster of my creation. I repassed in my memory my whole life, my quiet happiness while residing with my family in Geneva, the death of my mother and my departure for Ingolstadt. I remember shuddering the mad enthusiasm that carried me on to the creation of my hideous enemy, and I called to mind the night in which he first lived. I was unable to pursue the train of thought. A thousand feelings pressed upon me, and I wept bitterly. Ever since my recovery from the fever, I had been in the custom of taking every night a small quantity of laudanum, for it was by means of this drug only that I was enabled to gain the rest necessary for the preservation of life. Oppressed by the recollection of my various misfortunes, I now swallowed double my usual quantity and soon slept profoundly. But sleep did not afford me respite from thought and misery. My dreams presented a thousand objects that scared me. Towards morning I was possessed of a kind of nightmare. I felt the fiend's grasp in my neck, and I could not free myself from it. Groans and cries rang in my ears. But the father, who was watching over me, perceived my restlessness and woke me. The dashing waves were around, the sky cloudy above. The fiend was not here. A sense of security, a feeling that truce had been established between the present hour and the irresistible, disastrous future, imparted to me a kind of calm forgetfulness of which the human mind is, by its structure, particularly susceptible. Chapter 5. The voyage soon came to an end. We landed and proceeded to Paris. I soon found that I had overtaxed my strength and that I must repose before I could continue my journey. My father's care and attention were inflexible, but he did not know the origin of my sufferings and sought erroneous methods to remedy the incurable ill. He wished me to seek amusement in society. I abhorred the face of man. Oh, not abhorred. They were my brother and my fellow beings, and I felt attracted even to the most repulsive among them, as to creatures of an angelic nature and celestial mechanism. But I felt that I had no right to share their intercourse. I had enchained an enemy among them, whose joy it was to shed their blood and revel in their groans. How they would each and all abhor me and hunt me from the world. They did not know my unhallowed ass and the crimes that I had their source in me. My father yielded at length to my desire to avoid society and strove by various arguments to banish my despair. Sometimes he thought I felt deeply the degradation of being obliged to answer a charge of murder, and he endeavored to prove to me the futility of pride. "Alas, my father," I said, "how little you know me. Human beings, their feelings and passions would indeed be degraded if such a wretch as I felt pride. Justine, poor unhappy Justine, was as innocent as I, and she suffered the same charge. She died for it, and I am the cause of this. I murdered her. William, Justine, and Henry, they all died by my hands. My father had often during my imprisonment heard me make the same assertion, When I thus accused myself, he sometimes seemed desired an explanation, and at others he appeared to consider it as the offspring of delirium, and that during my illness some idea of this kind had presented itself to my imagination, the remembrance of which I had preserved in my convalescence. I avoided explanation and maintained a continual silence concerning the wretch I had created. I had a persuasion that I would be supposed mad, and this in itself would forever change my tongue. But besides, I cannot bring myself to disclose a secret which would fill my hearer with consternation and make fear and a natural horror of the intimates of his breast. I checked, therefore, my impatient thirst for sympathy, and was silent where I would given the world to have confided that fatal secret. Yet still words like those I have recorded would burst uncontrollably from me. I could offer no explanation of them, but their truth in part relieved the burden of my mysterious woe. Upon this occasion, my father said with an expression of unbounded wonder, "My dearest Victor, what an infatuation is this! My dear son, I entreat you never make such an assertion again." "I am not mad," I cried energetically. "The suns and the heavens who have viewed my operations can bear witness to my truth. I am the assassin of those most innocent victims. They died by my mechanisms. A thousand times I would have shed my own blood drop by drop to have saved their lives, but I could not. My father, indeed, I could not sacrifice the whole human race." The conclusion of the speech convinced my father that my ideas were deranged, and he instantly changed the subject of our conversation and endeavored to alter the course of my thoughts. He wished as much as possible to obliterate the memory of the scenes that had taken place in Ireland, and never alluded to them or suffered me to speak of my misfortunes. As time passed away, I became more calm. Misery had her dwelling in my heart, but no longer talked in the same incoherent manner of my own crimes. Sufficient for me was the consciousness of them. By the utmost self-violence, I curbed the imperious voice of wretchedness, which sometimes desired to declare itself to the whole world, and my manners were calmer and more composed than they had ever been since my journey to the Sea of Ice. A few days before we left Paris, on our way to Switzerland, I received the following letter from Elizabeth. "My dear friend, it gave me the greatest pleasure to receive a letter from my uncle dated at Paris. You are no longer a formidable distance, and I may hope to see you in less than a fortnight. My poor cousin, how much you must have suffered. I expect to see you looking even more ill than when you quitted Geneva. This winter has been passed more miserably, tortured as I have been by anxious suspense, yet I hope to see peace in your countenance and to find that your heart is not totally void of comfort and tranquility. Yet I fear that the same feelings now exist that made you so miserable a year ago, even perhaps augmented by time. I would not disturb you at this period when so many misfortunes weigh upon you, but a conversation that I had with my uncle previous to his departure renders some explanation necessary before we meet. Explanation, you may possibly say, what can Elizabeth have to explain? If you really say this, my questions are answered and all my doubts satisfied. That you are distant from me, and it is possible that you may dread and yet be pleased with this explanation, and in a probability of this being the case, I dare not hold any longer proposed writing what, during your absence, I have often wished to express to you, but have never had the courage to begin. You well know, Victor, that our union has been the favorite plan of your parents ever since our infancy. We were told this when we were young and taught to look forward to it as an event that would certainly take place. We were affectionate playfellows during childhood, and I believe dear and valued friends to one another as we grew older. But as brother and sister often entertain a lively affection towards each other without desiring a more intimate union, may not such also be our case? And tell me, dearest Victor, answer me, I conjure you by our mutual happiness with a single truth. Do you love another? You have traveled, you had spent several years of your life in Ingolstadt, and I confess to you, my friend, that when I saw you last Adam so unhappy, flying to solitude from the society of every creature, I could not help supposing that you might regret our connection, and believe yourself bound in honor to fill the wishes of your parents, although they oppose themselves to your inclinations. But this is false reasoning. I can confess to you, my friend, that I love you, and that in my airy dreams of futurity, You have been my constant friend and companion, but it is your happiness I desire as well as my own when I declare to you that our marriage would render me eternally miserable unless it were the dictate of your own free choice. Even now I weep to think that, borne down as you are by the cruelest misfortunes, you may stifle by word of honor all hopes that love and happiness, which alone would restore you to yourself. I, who have been so disinterested in affection for you, may increase your miseries tenfold by being an obstacle to your wishes. Ah, Victor, please be assured that your cousin and playmate has too sincere a love for you to be made miserable by this supposition. Be happy, my friend, and if you obey me in this one request, remain satisfied that nothing on earth will have the power to interrupt my tranquility. Do not let this letter disturb you. Do not answer tomorrow or the next day or even until you come, if it will give you pain. My uncle will send news to me of your health, and if I see but one smile on your lips when we meet, occasioned by this or any other exertion of mine, I shall need no other happiness. Elizabeth Levizina, Geneva, May 18th. This letter revived my memory, what I had before forgotten, the threat of the fiend, I will be with you on your wedding night. Such was my sentence, and on the night would the demon employ every art to destroy me and tear me from my glimpse of happiness, which promised partly to console my suffering. On that night he determined to consummate his crimes by my death. Well, be it so. A deadly struggle would then assuredly take place, in which, if he were victorious, I should be at peace, and his power over me be at an end. If he were vanquished, I should be a free man. Alas, what freedom! Such as the peasant enjoys when his family have been massacred before his eyes, his cottage burnt, his lands laid waste, and he is returned adrift, homeless, penniless, and alone, but free. Such would be my liberty, except that my Elizabeth, I possessed a treasure. Alas, balanced by those horrors of remorse and guilt which would pursue me into death. Sweet and beloved is Elizabeth. I read and reread her letter with some softened feelings stole into my heart, and I dared to whisper paradisical dreams of love and joy. But the apple was already eaten, and the angel's arm bare to drive me from all hope. Yet I would die to make her happy. If the monster executed his threat, death was inevitable yet again. I considered whether my marriage would hasten my fate. My destruction might indeed survive a few months sooner, but if my torturer should suspect I postponed it, influenced by his menaces, he would surely find another and perhaps more dreadful means of revenge. He had vowed to be with me on my wedding night, yet he did not consider that threat as binding him to peace in the meantime. For, as if to show me that he was not satiated with blood, he had murdered Clerval immediately after the enunciation of his threats. I resolved, therefore, that if my immediate union with my cousin would conduce either to hers or to my father's happiness, my adversary designs against my life should not retard it a single hour. In this state of mind, I wrote to Elizabeth. My letter was calm and affectionate. I fear, my beloved girl, I said, this little happiness remains for us on earth. Yet all that I may one day enjoy is centered in you. Chase away your idle fears. To you alone I do consecrate my life and my endeavors for contentment. I have one secret, Elizabeth, a dreadful one. When revealed to you, it will chill your frame and horror. And then, far from being surprised at my misery, you will only wonder that I survived what I have endured. I will confide this tale of misery and terror to you the day after our marriage shall take place. For, my sweet cousin, there must be perfect confidence between us. But until then, I conjure you, do not mention or allude to it. This I most earnestly entreat, and I know you will comply. In about a week after the arrival of Elizabeth's letter, we returned to Geneva. The sweet girl welcomed me with warm affection, yet tears were in her eyes as she beheld my emancipated frame and feverish cheeks. I saw a change in her also. She was thinner and lost much of the heavenly vivacity that had before charmed me, but her gentleness and soft looks of compassion made her a more fit companion for one blasted and miserable as I. The tranquility which I now did enjoy did not endure. The memory brought madness with it, and when I thought of what had passed, a real insanity possessed me. Sometimes I was furious and burnt with rage, sometimes low and despondent. I neither spoke nor looked at anyone, but sat motionless, bewildered by the multitude of miseries that overcame me. Elizabeth alone had the power to draw me from these fits. Her gentle voice would soothe me when transported by passion, and inspire me with human feelings when sunk in torpor. She wept with me and for me. When reason returned, she would remonstrate and endeavor to inspire me with resignation. Ah, it is well for the unfortunate to resign, but for the guilty there is no peace. The agonies of remorse poison the luxury there is otherwise found in indulging the excess of grief. Soon after my arrival, my spouse spoke of my immediate marriage with Elizabeth. I remained silent. Have you then some other attachment? None on earth. I love Elizabeth and look forward to our union with delight. Let the day therefore be fixed, and on it I will consecrate myself in life or death to the happiness of my cousin. My dear Victor, do not speak thus. Heavy misfortunes had befallen us, but let us only cling closer to what remains, and transfer our love to those whom we have lost, to those who yet live. Our circle will be small, but bound close by the ties of affection and mutual misfortune. And when time shall have softened your desperate despair, new and dear objects of care will be born to replace those of whom we have been so cruelly deprived. Such were the lessons of my father, but to me the remembrance of the threat returned. Nor can you wonder that, omnipotent as the fiend had been in his deeds of blood, I should almost regard him as invincible, and that when he had pronounced the words, "I shall be with you on your wedding night," I should regard the threatened fate as unavoidable. But death was no evil to me. The loss of Elizabeth were balanced with it, and I therefore, with a contented, even cheerful countenance, agreed with my father that if my cousin would consent, the ceremony should take place in 10 days, and thus put, as I imagined, the seal to my fate. Great God, if for one instant I had thought what it might hellish intention of my fiendish adversary, I would rather have banished myself forever from my native country and wandered a friendless outcast over the earth than have consented to this miserable marriage. But as if possessed of magic powers, the monster had blinded me to his real intention, and when I thought that I had prepared only my own death, I hastened that of a far dearer victim. As the period fixed for our marriage drew nearer, whether from cowardice or prophetic feeling, I felt my heart sink within me, but I concealed my feelings by an appearance of hilarity that brought smiles and joy to the countenance of my father, but hardly deceived the ever watchful and nicer eye of Elizabeth. She looked forward to our union with contentment, and not unmingled with a little fear, which past misfortunes had impressed, that what now appeared certain and tangible happiness might soon dissipate into an airy dream, and leave no trace but deep and everlasting regret. Preparations were made for the event, congratulatory visits were received, and all wore a smiling appearance. I shut up as well I could in my own heart the anxiety that preyed there, and entered with seeming earnestness into the plans of my father, although they might only serve as the decorations of my tragedy. Though my father's exhortations, a part of the inheritance of Elizabeth, had been restored to her by the Austrian government, a small possession on the shores of Como belonged to her. It was agreed that immediately after our union we should proceed to Villa Levesina and spend our first days of happiness beside the beautiful lake near which it stood. In the meantime, I took every precaution to defend my person in case the fiend should openly attack me. I carried pistols and a dagger constantly about me and was ever on watch to prevent artifice, and by these means gained a deeper degree of tranquility. Indeed, as the period approached and the threat appeared more a delusion, not to be regarded as worthy to disturb my peace, while the happiness I hoped for in my marriage wore a greater appearance of certainty, and the day fixed for its solemnization drew nearer, and I heard it continually spoken of as an occurrence which no accident could possibly prevent. Elizabeth seemed happy. My tranquil demeanor contributed greatly to her calm mind, but on the day that was to fill my wishes and my destiny, she was melancholy, and a presentiment of evil pervaded her, and perhaps also she thought of the dreadful secret which I had promised to reveal to her on the following day. My father was in the meantime overjoyed, and in the bustled preparation only recognized in the melancholy of his niece the difference of a bride. After the ceremony was performed, a large party assembled at my father's, but it was agreed that Elizabeth and I should commence our journey by water, sleeping that night at Evian, and continuing our voyage on the next day. The day was fair and the wind favorable, and all smiled on our nuptial embarkation. Those were the last moments of my life during which I enjoyed the feeling of happiness. We passed rapidly along. The sun was hot, but we were sheltered from its rays by a kind of canopy, and while we enjoyed the beauty of the scene, sometimes on one side of the lake, where we saw Montsevre and the pleasant banks of Montreuil, and the distance surmounting all the beautiful Mont Blanc, and the assemblage of snowy mountains that the vain endeavor to emulate her. Sometimes, coasting the opposite bank, we saw the mighty Jura, opposing its dark side to the ambition that would quit its native country, and an almost insurmountable barrier to the invader who should wish to enslave it. I took the hand of Elizabeth. "You are sorrowful, my love. Ah, if you knew what I have suffered and what I yet may endure, you would endeavor to let me taste the quiet and freedom from despair that this one day at least permits me to enjoy." "Be happy, my dear Victor," replied Elizabeth. "There is, I hope, nothing to distress you, and be assured that if lively joy is not painted on my face, my heart is contented. Something whispers to me not to depend too much on the prospect that is open before us, but I will not listen to a sinister voice. Observe how fast we move along, and how the clouds, which sometimes obscure and sometimes drive above the dome of Mont Blanc, render this scene of beauty still more interesting. Look also at the innumerable fish that are swimming in the clear waters, where we can distinguish every pebble that lies at the bottom. What a divine day! How happy and serene all nature appears!" Thus Elizabeth endeavored to divert her thoughts and mine from all reflection upon melancholy subjects. But her temper was fluctuating. Joy for a few instants shone in her eyes, but it continually gave place to distraction and reverie. The sun sank lower in the heavens. We passed the river Drance and observed its path through the chasms of the higher and the glens of the lower hills. The Alps here come closer to the lake, and we approach the amphitheater of mountains from which forms its eastern boundaries. The spires of Evian shone under the woods that surrounded it, and the range of mountains above mountains by which it was overhang. The wind, which had hitherto carried us along with amazing rapidity, sunk in the sunset to a light breeze. The soft air just ruffled the water and caused a pleasant motion among the trees as we approached the shore, from which it wafted the most delightful scent of flowers and hay. The sun sunk beneath the horizon as we landed, and as I touched the shore, I felt those cares and fears revive, which soon would clasp me and cling to me forever. Chapter 6. It was 8 o'clock when we landed. We walked for a short time on the shore, enjoying the transitory light, and then retired to the inn and contemplated the lovely scene of waters, woods, and mountains, obscured in the darkness yet still displaying their black outlines. The winds, which had fallen in the south, now rose with great violence in the west. The moon had reached a summit in the heavens and was beginning to descend. The clouds crept across it swifter than the flight of the vultures and dimmed her rays, while the lake reflected the scene of the busy heavens, rendered still busier by the restless waves that were beginning to rise. Suddenly a heavy storm of rain descended. I had been calm during the day, but as soon as night obscured the shapes of objects, a thousand fears rose in my mind. I was anxious and watchful. While my right hand grasped a pistol which was hidden in my bosom, every sound terrified me. But I resolved that I would sell my life dearly and not shrink from the conflict till my own life or that of my adversary was extinguished. Elizabeth observed my agitation for some time in timid and fearful silence, but there was something in my glance which communicated terror to her, and trembling she asked, "What is it that agitates you, my dear Victor? What is it you fear?" "Oh, peace, peace, my love," I replied. "This night and all will be safe, but this night is dreadful, very dreadful." I passed an hour in this state of mind when suddenly I reflected how fearful the combat which I momentarily expected would be to my wife, and I earnestly entreated her to retire, resolving not to join her until I had obtained some knowledge as to the situation of my enemy. She left me, and I continued some time walking up and down the passages of the house and inspecting every corner that might afford a retreat to my adversary. But I discovered no trace of him and was beginning to conjecture that some fortunate chance had intervened to prevent the execution of his menaces, when suddenly I heard a shrill and deafening scream. It came from the room into which Elizabeth had retired. And as I heard it, the whole truth rushed into my mind. My arms dropped, and the motion of every muscle and fiber was suspended. I could feel the blood trickling in my veins and tickling to the extremities of my limbs. The state lasted but an instant. The scream was repeated, and I rushed into the room. Great God, why did I not then expire? Why am I here to relate the destruction of the best of hope, the purest creature of earth? She was there, lifeless and inanimate, thrown across the bed, her head hanging down, her pale and distorted features half covered by her hair. Everywhere I turn, I see the same figure, her bloodless arms, relaxed form flung by the murderer on his bridal bier. Could I behold this and live? Alas, life is obstinate and clings closest where it is most hated. For a moment only did I lose recollection, and I fell senseless on the ground. When I recovered, I'd find myself surrounded by people of the inn. Their countenance expressed a breathless terror, but the horror of the others appeared only as mockery, a shadow of the feelings that oppressed me. I escaped from them to the room where the body of Elizabeth lay. My love, my wife, so lately living, so dear, so worthy. She had been moved from the posture in which I had first beheld her, and now as she lay, her head upon her arm, and a handkerchief thrown across her face and neck, I might have supposed her asleep. I rushed towards her and embraced her with ardor, but the deadly languor and coldness of the limbs told me what I now held in my arms had ceased to be the Elizabeth whom I loved and cherished. The murderous mark of the fiendish grip on her neck, and the breath had ceased to issue from her lips. While I still hung over her, the agony of despair, I happened to look up. The window of the room had been darkened before, and I felt a kind of panic on seeing a pale yellow light of the moon illuminate the chamber. The shutters had been thrown back, and with a sensation of horror not to be described, I saw at the open window a figure of the most hideous and abhorred. A grin was on its face of the monster. It seemed to jeer as with his fiendish finger pointed toward the corpse of my wife. I rushed towards the window and, drawing a pistol from my bosom, fired. But he eluded me, leaped from his station, and running with the swiftness of lightning, plunged into the lake. The report of the pistol brought a crowd into the room, and I pointed to the spot where he disappeared, and we followed the tracks with boats. Nets were cast, but in vain. After passing several hours, we returned hopeless, most of my companions believing it to be a form of conjured up by my fancy. After having landed, they proceeded to search the country, parties going in different directions among the woods and vines. I attempted to accompany them and proceeded a short distance from the house, but my head whirled round and my steps were like those of a drunken man. I fell at last in a state of utter exhaustion. A film covered my eyes and my skin was parched with heat of fever. In this state, I was carried back and placed on a bed. Hardly conscious of what had happened, my eyes wandered round the room as if to seek something I had lost. After an interval, I arose, and by instinct crawled into the room where the corpse of my beloved lay. There were women weeping around. I hung over it and joined my sad tears to theirs. All this time, no distinct idea presented itself in my mind, but my thoughts rambled to various subjects, reflecting confusedly on my misfortune and their cause. I was bewildered in a cloud of wonder and horror. The death of William, the execution of Justine, the murder of Clavel, and lastly my wife. Even at that moment, I knew not that my only remaining friends were safe from the malignity of my fiend. My father even now might be writhing under his grasp, and Ernest might be dead at his feet. The idea made me shudder and recalled me to action. I started up and resolved to return to Geneva with all possible speed. Thank you for listening to Reading the Classics. I hope you have a lovely evening. Good night.